Thank you. So this is Tuesday, March 16th, Tompkins County Legislature, and we have a couple of public hearings tonight. So we're going to open for our public hearing, beginning with, let me read it, the Tompkins County Legislature holds a public hearing concerning possible submission of any New York State Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, funding application for the 2020 program year. Is there anyone here to speak to us about that public hearing?
Listen,
Megan?
Yes. I can just introduce this and explain that by New York State Homes and Community Renewal in their CDBG funding round, we're still in 2020. Good news, bad news. We hope for a 2021 program year later this year, but that's why today we're here to talk about the 2020 program year, where $49 million in total has been allocated for the various types of CDBG activities, and to give citizens an opportunity to weigh in on that while we're developing applications. And with us, we've got both Liz Cameron and Becky Sims from Environmental Health, who are actively working on a septic replacement program for up to $1 million, and also Jennifer Tavares from the Chamber of Commerce, who's helping the county develop a microenterprise application for $300,000. And if there are any specific questions for them, they're here as well.
All right. Sounds like some good applications on the way. Anyone here to speak to any of those? And hi, Jennifer, Liz, and Becky. Good to see you all. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on that, on the CDBG funding applications for the year 2020. That's closed. And then thank you very much for being here, ladies. Then I will open the public hearing for review of the recommended reimagining public safety report. Review of the recommended reimagining public safety report. Is there anyone here to speak to that? Peter Mesko, former sheriff.
Thank you, Leslie.
Mesko.
I appreciate it. Good evening, everybody. I am Peter Mesko. I served as the sheriff of Tompkins County from 1999 to 2010, and previous to that served 5 years on the legislature. I wanted to speak to you tonight about the reimagining police proposal in Ithaca and Tompkins County. I would strongly suggest that you separate yourselves from a majority, if not all, of the misguided or ill-informed proposals from the city mayor. I included in my comments, a recent letter to the editor that I wrote regarding my concerns, as well as my speaking tonight, that the clerk has to distribute to you. I am concerned about the mayor's disdain of the IPD staff and the union, and his desire, clearly, to bust the union instead of trying to truly negotiate, and I don't think that's in the spirit of what the governor's executive order is all about. Regarding the proposals from the administrator, I offer the following. First and foremost, the sheriff is elected by the voters of Tompkins County and serves the residents, not the county administrator nor the legislature, even though I worked with many of you at the time and like you and enjoy you. I'm just trying to point out the obvious. Second, the county administrator nor the legislature can impose policies on an elected sheriff regarding the operations of the sheriff's office. You do, of course, have control of the budget and other areas along those lines. One of the recommendations is to minimize traffic stops to allocate law enforcement to other activities. When I was sheriff, we did a study and a grant with the New York State Governor's Traffic Safety Committee years ago, and the results proved that positive, proactive traffic enforcement reduces accidents, injury, and death. I would suggest it's not a very good or smart idea to minimize traffic enforcement. Second, the sheriff, one of my favorites, as you that work with me remember, is a joint employer with the county. Civil service law was amended in December of 2000 to include, in the case of a county sheriff's office in those counties where the office of sheriff is an elected position, both the county and the sheriff shall be designated as a joint public employer for all purposes of the article. The article goes on to explain exactly what the purposes are. In the recommendations that I've read through, I see one common thread. The county will have to invest significant ongoing funding to provide additional mental health and social service functions that currently do not exist. Specifically, in addition, if you really want, and I believe many of you do, if not all of you, true police reform, you'll have to include significant ongoing funding for the new and additional training and labor costs of that to the sheriff's office and the ability to implement that and have the staff to carry out that change. In previous years when I was sheriff, things get caught for mental health services, both in the jail and out on the street. It has always been a constant struggle to have the needed funding for adequate numbers of deputies to answer calls, create a positive image and service relationship with county residents, and engage in a proactive traffic enforcement and other programs that benefit safety and well-being of all. I would strongly suggest, if you really want that change, and I know you do, you'll work in a positive manner with Sheriff Osborne to continue his ideas and programs regarding change. The sheriff is experienced, well-trained, educated, skilled, and the only employee ever at the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office that was trained and graduated from the FBI National Academy. Good luck with your deliberations. Positive change and public safety, solid public safety, await your support. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this public hearing? Reimagining public safety report.
Mr. Rivera.
Do myself. So my dogs are making noise behind me. Thank you for having us. I'm an outreach worker in Tompkins County. I work for two nonprofits, OAR and URO. I'm also part of the working group on reimagining policing, involved with community communications, and I was part of the data collecting group. We did several focus groups and among the most vulnerable and marginalized population in Ithaca. This is the population that the evidence suggests are disproportionately impacted by police practices. And our job was basically to collect the narratives of these individuals to see how their narratives would inform the data and the policy recommendations. As a result of the recommendations that were put forth, I went among this population and started recording and asking them how they felt about the recommendations. Rarely did I hear something negative about the recommendations. A lot of people, despite the fact that they have been historically disproportionately impacted by police practices, are very hopeful that the recommendations will somehow build new relationships with the community. As one individual put it, one of the suggestions, one of the recommendations is that the name of the IPD be changed to Community Resolution. And the individual pointed out that the word, if you want them to be involved in the community, the word community has to be involved in the naming of the offices. Few people spoke about defunding the police. In fact, we believe that some of the recommendations actually provide more funding for policing so they could provide the proper services when an individual is calling with mental health issues or issues that could be resolved with non-police approaches. So we've been collecting this data, and we feel that the narratives of these individuals are important because if their experience with policing is different, then the way they explain policing is also different. And a lot of people have fears and apprehensions about the way policing has been done in the past, but they are hopeful that policing in the future can be done in a way that builds relationships, that builds community, that builds trust. No one actually wants to defund the policing in a way that they want to abolish policing, but they want policing that works for them. I mean, if we look at the local county jail right now, at least 40% of the people there are people of color, despite the fact that they make up less than 6% of the population of Tompkins County. So either we have to accept this as a reality and try to work around it, or just allow things to continue as they are. Having said that, I just wanted to say that that these individuals that I interviewed, and we went back and asked some questions again, they seem very hopeful and very positive that the recommendations that have been put forward will somehow help build relationships. They don't agree with all of them, but they believe that little changes at a time will lead to the changes that we eventually want. And they believe this is a good step forward, and they're hopeful for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rivera. Anyone else? I see Zachary Wynn.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Zachary, if you don't mind speaking up just a little bit more.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. The entire impetus for this reform effort was an executive order from our embattled governor, Andrew Cuomo, due to the events surrounding the death of George Floyd. With the new video of George Floyd's nearly identical 2019 arrest that was released today, where he swallowed the drugs in his possession, it has become evident a false narrative was created and is at the heart of this issue. The reform mandate should be ignored, and I invite all members of the council to call on both Governor Cuomo and Mayor Svante Mirick to step down. Thank you very much, and I yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Matthew Swiger?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Matthew Schweiger. I've been a patrol officer here at IPD for over 4 years, and I'm here to talk about the research and data that went into the creation of this proposal. Now, before you dismiss the critique of an officer on research methods and findings, allow me to comment on my familiarity with academic research. I received my bachelor's degree in psychology, and in my academic career, I participated in and conducted several studies. I've even published a study on metacognition and metacomprehension with one of my professors that was presented at the Eastern Psychological Association. This is not to pretend I'm some type of expert in any way. This is just to point out that I have some familiarity with research, and because of that, I have some concerns. I'd like to start with an excerpt from the proposal itself, discussing the data collection and research methods and the limitations of community input. Quote, "The quick turnaround set by the executive order did not allow researchers to follow standard research methods for qualitative data collection. Because of this, the information gathered during this process should not be viewed as equally valid. For example, the community input, while informative, should not be understood as representing all community voices. There is very little quality control of the community input. We have little to no demographic or geographic information on respondents who participated in the community input process, making it impossible to judge whether respondents are representative of the broader Ithaca community or are primarily members of a single demographic. Additionally, we were able to identify some individual participation in more than one community session, which raised questions as to whether other forms of input came from unique participants. For example, some participants spoke at multiple community voices forums, sent email messages, left a voicemail, and sent a letter on behalf of an organization. The potential for repetition, unfacilitated process, and lack of quality control limits the usefulness of the information gathered through these venues," end quote. What immediately jumps to my mind in reading this is that it openly admits serious flaws in the data. It notes that some people were provided input multiple times, that they had little to no demographic or geographic information on them, they did not follow standard research methods, and that there is little quality control of this data. How can we propose such broad and sweeping radical change based off of such data? Additionally, there are points in the survey data that should be noted, such as 87% of city respondents being neutral, satisfied, or very satisfied with police services versus 13% that were unsatisfied. There was also a lot of data missing from the report. The following were not gathered, present, or referenced in the proposal. Percentage of police interactions by race, number of use of force incidents per year, rate of use of force incidents in relation to total calls service, breakdown of use of force incidents by race, number of complaints of excessive use of force per year, number of all category complaints against officers, number of justified category complaints against officers, number of officer-involved shootings, number of unlawful or unjustified officer-involved shootings, and the number of times the mobile command unit was deployed and for what purpose. My question to you all is this. How can we propose such broad and sweeping radical change based on data that the study itself admits is faulty and limited? How can we trust that this research came to the right conclusions about policing when it doesn't even reference or use of force statistics? I'm deeply troubled that the conclusions this report jumps to and the information or lack thereof it is based on. Because of this, I cannot in good conscience support this proposal, and I would urge you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you. And Matthew, thank you. And I have, Deborah, I do see you, but I will call on Mike Meskel.
Hello. My name is Mike Meskel. I lived in Tompkins County my entire life. As a son of a former Tompkins County legislator, I'd like to thank you all for your service. as I know this takes time away from your family. I'd like to speak with you about the recommendations proposed on the reimagining police reform. First is traffic safety. In this report, it is mentioned that a reduction of officer-initiated traffic stops needs to occur because it will decrease the number of interactions with law enforcement. As a crash reconstructionist and someone who has conducted many vehicle stops and taken hundreds of impaired drivers off the road, I couldn't disagree more. The top two killers of crashes on the roadway is speed and distraction, and in some cases, both. Without proactive enforcement of these types of infractions, the roadways will become more and more dangerous. Collecting data about the stops is a good idea, and much like the data collected by the city of Ithaca, which was withheld from this report, you will find that the overwhelming amount of traffic stops align with the current demographic of Tompkins County. The report also references 57% of tickets that are dismissed. I would ask you to ask the DA's office why that is, because police officers don't dismiss tickets. If you want to know how important traffic safety is, I would suggest contacting the governor's traffic safety committee. I'm sure they can introduce you to some of the families that have lost loved ones from traffic crashes. If that doesn't do it for you, YouTube JC Good, and she can explain how her parents were killed when she was just 21 years old. Secondly, the executive order 203 calls for collaboration of all stakeholders involved. So I'm curious, how many times, Mr. Merlino, have you been to the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office? How many members of the Sheriff's Office have you interacted with? Was there a 45-minute Zoom call for the members of the Sheriff's Office to attend so you could check a box for this report? Something I learned many years ago is there's two sides to every story, and only looking at this reform from one side will result in catastrophic failure. I urge you to all reach out to the hardworking members of the Sheriff's Office and have a conversation as to the level of input they had on this draft. Sheriff Osborne and Undersheriff Owen have already shown and proven change within the organization. Please don't handcuff them with a knee-jerk reaction. Lastly, the recommendation number one for the City of Ithaca is a radical way for Mayor Savante Myrick to get out of a labor contract. I'm curious as to why the only contracts on the website with all the reform information are the Ithaca PBA contracts. Shouldn't this be a sign? Maybe it's time the question should be asked. Whose idea was really recommendation number one to get rid of the IPD? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mesko. Deborah Dawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm speaking tonight on behalf of Faye Gagakis, with whom I had a lengthy conversation today. Faye, as you know, doesn't have a computer. And because of the pandemic, she's not been patronizing the library where she usually gets access to the computer. And she pointed out to me, people in her situation were at an extreme disadvantage, insofar as being able to access the executive order, the report, a lot of the news information that's been circulating about this proposal. In fact, she felt that she was at a real disadvantage because she didn't really understand what the proposal entailed. But she had, of course, heard about recommendation number one, which she was extremely concerned about. She felt that given how disadvantaged people without computers are in the time of COVID, that the timing of the executive order was unfortunate and really, sorry about my phone, and really indicated that the timing of the executive order and the timing of this examination was unfair and poorly chosen. She really felt that she didn't understand why the governor had imposed a hurry through this time of the pandemic. And she also expressed concern that a change as radical as reconstructing the city police department shouldn't be rushed and shouldn't be reactive. And she feels that the county probably shouldn't be voting on that recommendation, although I did assure her that several of us had no intention of doing so. So I just wanted to share that because Faye didn't have the opportunity to be here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah, for representing Faye and her voice. Anyone else to speak to the public hearing? I see Belisa, Dr. Belisa Gonzalez.
Hi, thank you. So I just wanted to comment on an earlier statement about the data collection methods. As one of the people who was in charge of the methodology, I wanted to clarify something. So the distinction, the quote that was read was about the limitations of the community input and our lack of control over that part. However, the data, and I do use those two terms separately. So input was the community forums, the community voices that I thought that, you know, the city and the county did as best the job they could, you know, taking not only in sort of digital format like we are now, but also, you know, bringing forums to people for the reasons that the previous speaker talked about. You know, to get input. And so that we have very little information. And the quote that the two speakers ago, I think it was maybe three, spoke about was about that input and really trying to say, we have to be very careful about thinking that that is representative, that those voices are representative of a larger community, because we can't know that. However, the focus group data, which was the, what we were charged to the folks that we were charged to make extra efforts to reach out to because of the executive order 203, so communities of color, houseless communities, communities that have been recently returned from being incarcerated, folks without access to computers. Although I will say that the pandemic and doing things over Zoom actually increased in some cases our participation of some targeted community members, so it had a kind of mixed effect that way. That those focus groups were conducted and that information in a methodologically sound way. You know, my partner, Dr. Sean Eversley Bradwell, and myself conducted the analysis. And so I just want to be clear that now he did speak to a couple, not Sean, but the previous speaker did speak to a couple of other types of data. We were not charged with that part, so I can't speak to that. So I'm only speaking to the methodological soundness of the focus group data and the themes that we found from analyzing that data. And I do also, just from the previous speaker, want to say that, you know, Richard Rivera and Tammy, I apologize, Tammy, I'm forgetting your last name, but did a lot of work to reach out to folks who did not have access to computers. And we actually did conduct three in-person focus groups to specifically target those folks. So I appreciate that comment and the attention paid to people who, you know, who are disproportionately impacted by our reliance on technology. And we did our best to reach out to those folks as well. So I just wanted you also to know that. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gonzalez. Is there anyone else here to speak to the public hearing on reimagining public safety on the report? I'm going to page number two to see if anybody else is still raising their hands, because I can only see page number one. Seeing no one else, I also want to emphasize that we did receive some comments via email as well. So thank you to everyone who came out to speak to it. Continue to send your comments, you know, to us. We want this to be as engaging a process as possible and want to hear from as many voices. We appreciate your time, and I will call this public hearing to a close. Okay, close the public hearing. Thank you all. And now we're going to move to the regular Tuesday, March 16th, 2021 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Roll call of members.
Okay. Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna?
Here.
Gwen Morey has asked to be excused. Martha Robertson?
Here.
Mike Sigler?
Here. Here.
Donna Black?
Here.
Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Henry Granison?
Present.
Rich John?
Here.
Dan Klein?
Here.
Ann Corman?
Present.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Present.
With 12 members present.
Thank you very much. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. You would have received any communications. We have a few proclamations for this evening, and I will be calling on some individuals to help read those proclamations so you don't have to be subjected to my voice the entire time. Starting with proclamation celebrating Women's History Month. Henry, is that you? Are you there?
Yes. And out of proclamation to Bobby. What? And I'm proclamation for me, so.
You do not?
No. Maybe Martha can read it, or?
Martha, do you have it?
I'll get it there in a second. Hold on. Yeah, and thank you so much to Henry for writing this. Final as resolved. I think I have it. And Deanna Carithers also very generously put quite a bit of time into this. In fact, she I think drafted the first version. So if that's going to go ahead with it.
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you. Proclamation celebrating Women's History Month. Whereas Women's History Month is a celebration of women's contributions to history, culture, and society, and has been observed annually in the month of March in the United States since 1987. And whereas in 1978, the school district of Sonoma, California participated in Women's History Week, an event designed around the week of March 8th, International Women's Day, which was a precursor to Women's History Month. And whereas the 2021 Women's History Month theme is a continuation of 2020's Valiant Women of the Vote, Refusing to be Silenced, which recognizes the battle for women's suffrage, which was theoretically gained with the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, but was not fully secured in law for all women until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And whereas women have served as early leaders in the forefront of every major progressive social change movement to create a more fair and just society for all, despite their treatment as second-class citizens and denial of the full rights and privileges that are available to male citizens of the United States. And whereas we can all choose to challenge and call out gender bias and inequality. And whereas President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act into law in 1963, prohibiting sex-based wage discrimination between men and women performing the same job in the same workplace. And President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law in 1964, which banned employment discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, or sex. And whereas COVID-19 has compounded the challenges for women throughout the world, especially for women in the workforce, in addition to the heavier role of women in childcare and elder care, the uptick in domestic violence, and the preponderance of women in service and other public-facing jobs, COVID-19 has actually slowed the progress of gender equity and inclusion. And whereas women here and elsewhere continue to unite to advocate that these rights and privileges be available to all citizens equally, and whereas this year the Tompkins County Historical Commission will celebrate the rich history of women to honor local individuals who played a key role in the movement, including physician Samantha Nivison, educators Jacqueline Elizabeth Melton Scott, Martha Van Rensselaer, and Emma Corrine Brown Galvin, and suffragist Louisa Riley, and more, these 19th and early 20th century women represent the best of a group that toiled in obscurity for the greater community. And whereas the diversity and inclusion of women of every race, ethnicity, religion, age, sexual orientation, national origin, disability status, protected veteran status, and expression should be honored and uplifted. And whereas we elevate and recognize the monumental achievement of the election of Kamala Harris, the daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, who was sworn in on January 20, 2021, as the first woman and first woman of color vice president of the United States. And whereas women throughout history have demonstrated an unbreakable resolve in pursuit of justice, equity, inclusion. Therefore, you, Leslyn McBean Claiborne, chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim that the Tompkins County Legislature celebrates the brave women who fought to win suffrage, civil and economic rights for women, and designate the month of March 2021 to celebrate Women's History Month.
Thank you very much, Martha, and thank you to all who worked on that proclamation. And yes, this woman is happy to sign and designate this month as Women's History Month in Tompkins County. Thank you, Henry, and the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee for moving this forward as well. We have a guest with us. We have some other proclamations. I am going to, if it's okay with our guests, to just bear with us while we get through the proclamations, and then we will get to our colleagues who are joining us from Cornell for a Q&A. So let's get through the rest of our proclamations. Thank you all for your patience. Proclamation in honor of those we lost to the coronavirus. Henry Granison.
Yes. Whereas on January 30th, 2020, the World Health Organization designated the novel coronavirus, Corona 19, outbreak as a public health emergency of international concern. And whereas on January 31st, 2020, the United States Health and Human Services Secretary Alex M. Azar II delivered a public health emergency for the entire United States to aid the nation's healthcare community in responding to COVID-19. And whereas on March 7th, 2020, Mario M. Cuomo, Governor of New York State, declared a disaster emergency in the state of New York to address the threat of COVID-19 poses to the health and welfare of its residents and visitors. And the state of emergency was declared in Tompkins County in response to the COVID-19 pandemic effective March 13th, 2020. And whereas Governor Cuomo has issued and continues to issue executive orders directing actions in response to the COVID-19 pandemic in New York State. And whereas on March 14th, 2020, Tompkins County tested its first residents for COVID-19, and on March 16th, 2020, exactly 1 year from the day, Tompkins County registered its first positive test. And whereas so that we first reported COVID-19 case in Tompkins County, Cayuga Health Systems has provided Tompkins County and other adjacent communities with easy, fast, and safe COVID-19 testing. And as of March 9, 2021, there have been more than 850,000 tests done in the Tompkins County region. And whereas on October 12th, we lost our first Tompkins County resident to the COVID-19 pandemic, after going nearly 7 months without suffering a single COVID-19 fatality. And whereas by March 9th, 2021, there were more than 29 million known cases of the virus in the United States, and more than 535,000 people tragically lost their lives. And whereas by March 9th, 2021, there were more than 350 cases 3,500 known cases of the virus in Tompkins County, and 29 people tragically lost their lives. And whereas COVID-19 has had a disproportionate impact on low-income communities and communities of color, with high rates of infection and death, exacerbating inequalities already prevalent in all systems that we must address as a nation. And whereas public servants, frontline essential workers, and healthcare professionals have taken selfless actions to protect the neighborhoods, to protect their neighbors and communities, supporting struggling local economies, and finding innovative ways to provide services. And local, state, tribal, and federal government entities have provided critical support to businesses, communities, and people in need. And whereas COVID-19 pandemic continues to have an impact on Tompkins County, the United States, and countries around the world. Whereas each life lost to COVID-19, each inequality and broken system brought to light, and each sacrifice made shall be never be forgotten. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Tompkins County Legislature, we honor the loss of every person who died or has been sickened by COVID-19. Resolve further that we urge local residents to continue to take preventive measures, including social distancing and following public health orders, to mitigate the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Resolve further that this resolution pays tribute to the essential health workers, to those who have risen in service. The witness, wherefore I've, well, I'll skip that part.
Thank you, Henry, for such an important proclamation. Indeed, we do honor every life lost and everyone sickened by this disease. So thank you for bringing that forward.
Thank you.
And the message in there also continuing to encourage people to follow the guidelines of public health, so that we can mitigate the spread. Get vaccinated, roll up those sleeves, continue to wear your mask, continue to distance, wash your hands, etc. Thank you very much. We have two more to go, special announcement and a Q&A. This will be right on time for our guest from Cornell. Mike Ziegler.
Hi, everybody. Sort of proclamation for Agriculture Month. So obviously Lansing, big farming community, so is a lot of Tompkins. So Agriculture Month, whereas March signifies a national celebration of the importance of food and agriculture in the United States, as it provides almost everything we eat and use every day. This month, we recognize and celebrate the diversity and abundance provided by New York's farms and our growing food and agricultural sector, and the contributions of Tompkins County's family farmers. Whereas there are 33,400 farms in New York State and 6,900,000 acres of operated farmland, and whereas the agricultural industry of New York State contributed more than $5.4 billion in agricultural economy sales to the New York economy each year, and whereas with farmland occupying nearly one quarter of New York State's land area, agriculture also promotes New Yorkers' quality of life in other ways, including providing access to fresh, locally sourced food, preserving open space, and enhancing communities through farmers markets and other such activities. And whereas recognizing the month of March as Agriculture Month in Tompkins County provides the opportunity for all residents of Tompkins County and New York to better appreciate agriculture's breadth and beauty, how food and fiber products are produced, and the role agriculture plays in providing safe, abundant, and affordable products. And whereas commemorating Agriculture Month will build awareness of the benefits of the agricultural industry in Tompkins County and encourage young people to consider agriculture as a career. And furthermore, I urge all New Yorkers to join me in recognizing the importance of our food and agriculture industry, to thank a farmer for providing the food we eat, and to help celebrate every month with meals made from a variety of New York State products. Now, therefore, Luslin McBean Claiborne, Chairman of the Tompkins County Board of Legislators, does hereby proclaim the month of March 2021 as Agriculture Month in Tompkins County. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for the recognition. And from all of us, thanks to all our farmers and farm workers. We certainly would not be here and surviving food in our stores without them. So thank you for that. I am going to read one last proclamation, and this is a proclamation honoring the late Sergeant William L. Beebe III, Tompkins County Sheriff's Department. Whereas William L. Beebe III, a son of Tompkins County, served in the United States Armed Forces as a military police sergeant in the U.S. Air Force, and whereas, following his military service, Mr. Beebe returned to Tompkins County and continued his service to the people through his appointment as a Tompkins County Sheriff's Deputy by Sheriff Robert L. Howard in February 1972. And whereas, Mr. Beebe made history as the first Black or African-American person to be hired as a deputy sheriff in Tompkins County, becoming the first of only two Black deputies to ever be hired by the Tompkins County Sheriff's Department, the second being Tim Little at his hire in July 1999. And whereas Mr. Beebe's professionalism and knowledge of the job earned him a promotion to the position of Sergeant Deputy Sheriff in July 1981, and whereas in that role he served as Shift Commander and Road Patrol Supervisor until his resignation in 1983, and whereas in his various roles in the community, Mr. Beebe remained committed to public safety, later serving as the Supervisor of Security and Fire Protection of Berg Warner Automotive and the Park Ada Taganic Falls State Park, where he enjoyed patrolling the trails and greeting visitors, and as a police commissioner on the City of Ithaca Community Police Board during the administration of Mayor Carolyn Peterson. And whereas upon his passing on March 6, 2021, some community members shared with Mr. Beebe's family that he was the reason they pursued law enforcement careers. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the members of the Tompkins County Legislature honor the late Mr. William L. Beebe III for his service as the first Black African-American deputy sheriff in Tompkins County, and be it further resolved that the legislature encourages all residents to recognize his service to the community as an important part of Tompkins County history. And on behalf of the entire legislature, we do send our condolences to his family, who are lifelong residents of Tompkins County. Thank you all. Martha.
Can we have a moment of silence?
I was just about to say that, Mike. Martha also mentioned, which I didn't get to add to the proclamation, that Mr. Beebe will often patrol the parking lot and have conversations with folks, just, you know, sharing how things are going, you know, ideas, whatever it may be. So we thank Mr. Beebe for continuing to be as encouraging to our citizens. And I will ask for your indulgence. Thank you, Mike, for a moment of silence in honor of William, the late Sergeant William L. Beebe III, Tompkins County Sheriff's Department. Thank you. Thank you. May he continue to rest in peace and in service. All right. We are also have one very special announcement, and I would like to invite Jennifer Tavares, not a full proclamation, but an announcement. Jennifer? You're muted, Jennifer.
I swear I clicked that button. Thank you for letting me have just a moment. I think probably many of you have already seen this, but since I happen to be here, I wanted to share that. And really, I think the timing is quite fitting as we all take a moment to reflect on the last year and everything that we've all experienced together. I wanted to share some gratitude for the team that you have at Tompkins County. And while I know there's probably hundreds of people that work for the county that have played a really big part in helping us manage this crisis the way that we have as a community, we actually had a new community hero recognition award that we just started doing this month in conjunction with Tompkins Trust Company. And the first awardees of this new community hero award are actually Jason Molino, Amy Hendricks, Frank Krupa, and Dominic Recchio. So there's been an awful lot shared on social media. A press release went out today. If you look on the internet, you'll probably see their wonderful faces. I know we all feel, except for Jason's beard, you can, you know, disregard the new look that he's got going. I'm just kidding, Jason. I remember early on when Jason was picking on Frank, for his facial hair, so I had to give him a little nudge there. But, you know, again, you have so many incredible people that have helped lead the county and the community through this, but, these four really have stood out to us and to several others in the community. And, no award and no amount of, thanking them publicly will, be enough or feel like enough. And I know they're all very humble. And so they probably, are embarrassed and probably don't want to accept our public thanks, but, I'm grateful that we were able to do this. They're so deserving of our gratitude and, again, looking forward to being able to recognize more community heroes in the coming months, but it was really wonderful to be able to start with this group of folks from Tompkins County. So thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, the Tompkins Trust Company, Chamber of Commerce, for recognizing the incredible work that our heroes and sheroes have done in keeping our community safe throughout this pandemic. And it is that was really lovely. Thank you. And this is a good segue to invite, I'm rearranging things a little bit, inviting our friends and colleagues and partners in this work from Cornell University to join us. I see Joel Molina, and hi, to share with us Diane Miller, Charlie Krasinski, and Karen Brown. Thank you all for being here. Again, if there are others on the other screen, I can't see you. But thank you for being here. And take it away. We're glad that you can come back and join us.
Thank you. It is absolutely our pleasure, Leslyn and all members of the legislature. I do remember it was the first time since the once the pandemic started that we were visiting, where I believe, Leslyn, you had expressed your hope that we would continue these outreach efforts even once we're beyond the pandemic. And we are absolutely on board with that. These have been great opportunities for us to listen and learn and to share and to engage with important partners. So we're glad to be here tonight. Last night, we were visiting with the Downtown Ithaca Alliance. We have an upcoming general public town hall on the 25th, this time at 9 a.m., and we'll continue on this schedule going forward. I do want to start with an ongoing expression of appreciation to both the county elected and staff leadership for so many collaborations over the last year. We have had challenges, but we've also had a number of wonderful shared successes. Our relationship with the county is a tremendous source of pride across our campus for me and my team personally, and we very much admire and appreciate the advice and the expertise that you bring to your jobs and our interactions. I thought I would spend just a few minutes giving a brief COVID update, and then if it would be helpful, we do have Charlie and Diane on. I know last week when we met with representatives from several municipal governments, we began those sessions with just brief observations from Diane and Charlie about the now enacted law that will thankfully deliver some much needed state and local federal support. And then we can open it up to general Q&A. So on the COVID front, you know, we are seeing what we're all experiencing, which is pandemic fatigue. Our numbers this semester are trending higher than they were last semester. From a percentage, a prevalence percentage perspective, it's not concerning. We engage daily with Frank Krupa and his team, and these are not signs that are concerning to them. But it's noticeable given the significant low prevalence we had last semester. Our public dashboard was just updated with data from going through last evening. And we have, looking at the last 3 days, zero positivities, zero cases confirmed among employees, but 19 among our students. We did have two wellness days last week, which were a substitution for a spring break. The good weather, no doubt, added to perhaps too much of a enticement to fall short on following through on all of the behavioral guidelines. Overwhelmingly, our students continue to pay strict attention, but it has become challenging to have that be across the entire population. Importantly, we continue to communicate with them regularly. Our president, Martha Pollack, and Ryan Lombardi, our vice president of Student and Campus Life, sent a message just this afternoon exploring and imploring our group, our community, to really do what we can. We've got 9 weeks left in the semester, and now is not the time to let our guard down. A lot of interest in vaccination, obviously. The eligibility from the state continues to gradually expand. So more and more of our campus community members will now be able, supply, of course, being the unknown, to begin to be vaccinated. We have had an application filed with the state to be in a position to distribute the vaccine ourselves. We have not yet received a response on that from the state, but we're hoping that would put us in a position to help take on some of the burden that the health department and the hospital system are undertaking so well on their own. I'll just end on COVID by thanking Frank and his entire team at the health department. They have been tremendous, insightful partners who we've relied on each day to help us analyze what we're seeing and to ensure that the decisions that we're making on the Hill are first and foremost helping the broad community to ensure that we get through this as one community as quickly as possible. With that, let me turn to Diane Miller. For those who don't know Diane, she's our Senior Director of Federal Relations. She runs our office in Washington, D.C. Diane, why don't you talk a bit about the law? And then Charlie Krasanski, who's our Associate Vice President in Albany, will talk about the New York aspects. And Charlie, I love the sweater. I don't believe I've seen you in that colorful an outfit before.
It is pretty awesome, isn't it? And, you know, it's so much nicer to deliver good news than not. And, by now, I think you've probably all had a chance to go through the American Rescue Plan. And so know that the $350 billion that's targeted in direct aid to state and local governments survived intact. I think the biggest thing that they did was they peeled $10 billion off the top to create an infrastructure fund that you have to apply to, or there's some of it's distributed by formula, but then there's an application process in there. Looked up the specifics of this particular program. The aid is going to be distributed directly by the Treasury Department. The first tranche has to be released within 60 days, the date of enactment, so mid-May. I imagine there will be a lot of guidelines coming down because there's not a formula or program that it's going through. So unlike the transit funds where it just runs through the FTA's formula to the grantees, this one's a new program, but very exciting. I think it was a very critical part of our advocacy. Cornell's advocacy was making sure that our that our government was taking care of, because so many services that you provide, we rely on to do our job. In addition to that direct assistance, there's also a number of other funding streams. So the K-12 funding, social services block grant funding, food assistance, rental assistance, housing vouchers, FMAP support, premium support, aid to individuals. So I think it's a lot of really just, and then of course the funding for the higher education, which is so important for Cornell. So, in that sense, I think it really did take a look at the full landscape, provide funding for the sectors where there still were needs available. And so anyway, like I said, it's always better to give good news than not. And Charlie will tell you about what the state may or may not do with its direct allocation.
Sure, I'd love to. Thanks. The state budget is not done, but it's getting done. The two houses have come out with their own proposals in response to the governor's budget. So we now know all three parties. So we have a very good idea what it looked like. The biggest factor was that federal money. So that Diane talked about, where the governor drew a line of the sand in January. He said, I need $15 billion to fill the 2-year hole that this pandemic has created. And he's getting, for him to allocate, for him, again, they're going to allocate, they're going to appropriate in the budget. But again, he has control over steering a lot of it, even after it's been appropriated, the timing and exactly what it's for. And he's one of three parties negotiating the budget, $12.5 billion. That's awfully close to 15. So almost all the cuts go away that the governor was talking about. In addition, they will be adding money to because like Diane said, there's money going direct to hospitals, to the community college. TC3 is going to get direct money, as will Cornell, Ithaca College, but then transit systems. There's direct money, of course, local governments. Those are holes that no longer have to be filled. So they now have money to spend on additional things. So in addition to that, and again, you'll see a bigger budget than we would have had before. So it is not going to just fill some holes. In addition, the state economy is doing a little better than the governor thought it was going to do in January when he put out his budget. And so they increased the revenues they have to spend by $2.5 billion earlier this month. So they're sort of looking at strategically basically rebuilding some of the safety net in New York, a lot of it caused by the pandemic, a lot of it pre-pandemic. Then they're doing things like broadband. They're investing in broadband. They're investing in some infrastructure. More, water treatment facilities, those kinds of investments. And, just because, again, they thought they'd be in a fiscal hole and now they have some money to make these targeted investments. And that's what I think this budget will look like when it's all said and done. And I'll say that I think the governor's weakened position will prevent him from really being the loudest voice in the room. He'll just be one of three. So I think he won't have the normal control that a governor would have over this budget. I think he'll just be happy to be there and to sign it. And it'll go into the one thing you can sort of count on. It'll be on time if Governor Cuomo's in the room. He always makes sure it's on time. So that's what I'm expecting, that kind of a budget with those positive numbers rather than big negatives.
So with that, we'd be happy to take questions either on the state and local funding, COVID, or anything that might be on your mind.
Thank you also very much. Does anyone have any questions? Martha, and then Mike Lane?
I think Mike was first.
I didn't see who went up first, but I'm just going across my screen. So somebody go.
All right. Well, I'm unmuted already. So thank you all very, very much. Charlie and Diane have been enormously generous with their time with the Tiger Committee, Intergovernmental Resources Committee. And so it's been wonderful to have your updates every month. Thank you. I would ask, you know, it is interesting to see, you know, a shift in the dynamics. And I hope that some of the things that we've heard from NYSEC, for example, NYSEC seems to think that the AIM money that's been withheld, aid to to municipalities, will get restored. We're also pushing that the 5% withholding, across the board withholding in state reimbursements, would get restored, given all the good news. Charlie, do you have any sense of those from your point of view?
I've seen the AIM in at least one of the two legislative budgets, so that's a good sign. And then the 5%, that's really the governor has been withholding this 5%, and my crystal ball says that he will relent and let, you know, localities have that 5%. In some, not across the board yet, but in some strategic, you know, when we've even gone in for some strategically, hey, this is important for this reason, and they've said on a case-by-case basis, fine, you can have it all. I just think when all the money, when they, you know, again, the federal law was just signed. I think with a little bit more time, they're going to get comfortable. Okay, now we see what we have. Yeah, I think those cuts go away. That's my guess.
I hope so, because we're worried that that would become then a new floor, a new sort of the target funding would be 5% less. And then if I could just ask quickly, do you folks have any projection on commencement yet?
We do not. And it's mostly because the state has not yet provided the guidance. Charlie and Mary Opperman were both on a call yesterday that was convened by KIKU, the Private University Trade Association. Everyone is waiting. These are critical decisions that, as I know you can appreciate, you can't just turn on a decision. You've got to plan for it. We are very, very hopeful that we'll be able to celebrate our students' achievements in a meaningful way, but we just don't yet know. We are hoping to be able to make an announcement, as President Pollack has indicated, by the end of March, so that gives us another 2 weeks. Charlie, I don't know if there's more that you would add, but it's been very frustrating.
Thank you very much.
And I will note, we absolutely recognize how important our commencement plans are to the broader community, to your businesses, to our friends. We want this to be a time for economic prosperity for all, with all of the influx of people. We just don't know if it's possible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike Lane.
Well, Martha was asked a question I was going to ask about commencement, so
me too.
We'll keep our fingers crossed, because Joel, as you note, when Cornell catches cold, the county economy sneezes, so we have to be very dependent on one another, and we want to recover as we can, but we want to do it safely.
Right.
And so having you four come tonight is a big advantage to us. Thank you for that. And I'll join in what Martha said, particularly about Diane and Charlie coming to the Tiger meetings we have. What an asset that is for you to share their time, your time with us. We learn so much, and that's part of what a university like Cornell is about, education. How much education you do for this legislature by being there every month. Thank you.
Mike, thank you very much. That's extraordinarily kind. I will say that Charlie and Diane are phenomenal resources that we're proud to be able to share with all of you.
I will say this is one of the advantages of this Zoom platform, because I have never participated in the local government meetings before. And so just, you know, appreciate the invitation. And I was not, you know, this does help me do my job better, just to get this perspective. And so thank you for inviting us.
Well, definitely echo what my colleague said, and we're glad that you can do that. And one of the things that we strive to do is to build relationships with our partners in the community. And, you know, this has certainly been a good way for us to do that rather than just two or three of us meeting in a room occasionally, you know, once a year or twice a year. It makes a huge difference when others of us can attend and people can be present and we can hear and work together. So thank you for that. I have Henry, and then I have Dave McKenna.
Yes, thank you, Joe, for your presentation. I was wondering whether you have any update on when the staff will be returning from remote working.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest. We had a all-staff Zoom forum last week, and that was the most popular question. Mary Opperman and a team are beginning the very complicated effort to imagine what the future might look like, what opportunities there will be for those who would like to remain remote, as well as to accommodate those who want the flexibility, even if they're in person again, to be able to have that flexibility on a case-by-case basis to spend some time remote. We have a lot of work to do before we're in a position to knowing what that will look like, but we are starting it in earnest. It is one of the nice things about our all seeing the light at the end of this long COVID tunnel is we can begin to imagine and plan for what post-pandemic life will look like. I will say I was in a meeting today where there was a lot of expression of desire for us to once again be able to populate our campus. It is interesting for those of us who are on campus, some more often than others, you know, it's mostly students. There aren't a whole lot of adults around. And there are a lot of benefits to having that vibrant mix of what makes the Cornell campus such an exciting place to be. We're very much looking forward to moving back to some semblance of what we all loved so much.
Can I ask you another question about how sure. Your percentage of testing is going this semester versus last semester in terms of the students and the staff?
Yeah, well, first in terms of surveillance testing following the required testing protocols, it's been exceedingly well. I heard yesterday, I think the high 90%, like 96, 97% of compliance, which is terrific. Now, that doesn't equate to having all negative results. So we are seeing that, you know, higher than where we were last semester. You know, not, in the scheme of things, worrisome, but enough of a concern that we are paying close attention to it. The good news is when we had our cluster early, and even with some of the bigger numbers that we have seen in recent weeks, you know, it tends to rise and then decrease. And then when it rises, it doesn't rise to a scary level. It's just a place that we've been before where we'd rather not return. So it's a mix of things that I mentioned earlier. We don't want the change in weather. We don't want the perception that people are getting vaccinated to get around the fact that we need to stick with these very important guidelines. We'll be strong advocates of that. The important determination we have to make, though, is you need to have the balance between, you know, waving that hammer, you know, of punishment versus trying to recognize that there are challenges from a wellness perspective that students are craving interactions that could be done safely. So one of the things that we mentioned in our message today, yes, it was a reminder of sticking with the hard behavioral requirements, but it also began to loosen certain structured outdoor opportunities. Again, if it's masked, if it's done in small groups, we learned last semester that it's absolutely safe, but we want to avoid those unsupervised, spontaneous social bursts, and that we feel we can find that middle ground by providing these opportunities that will provide that much-needed release.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Couple of others, and then we can wrap. Dave McKenna, Shauna Black, and then Rich John.
Thank you. And thank you, Joel, for coming with all your contingent people. We appreciate the information. My question is just pretty frivolous in a way. I'm just curious, are you planning anything towards reunions this year and, you know, maybe later in the summer or something like that?
Yeah, reunions were actually a decision we had to make early because when you're talking about individual reunion planning, there are multiple dozens, if not hundreds, of actual committees that need to do planning way out in advance. So we made the decision already about a month ago that our reunions would be all virtual, which impacted not just our reunion classes, but we had every hope that our class of 2020, which was denied an in-person commencement ceremony, we had hoped to have them be a part of a celebration in person during reunion. So that was a decision that was made. It was unfortunate, but we are hoping that we'll be able to look ahead to not having to make those decisions in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Shauna Black?
Hi there. I wanted to ask about the students' mental health and see if there had been an increase of students that are seeking mental health and what Cornell is doing about that.
Thank you, Shauna. I've got two colleagues, Pat Wynn and Karen Brown from Student and Campus Life. I don't know if either of them would be able to speak to that question.
Yeah, I can. I don't have any numbers for you, Shauna. But, you know, obviously we've been concerned about mental health, you know, since the fall, quite frankly. And it's been really hard on the students. And that is a reason why we are trying to open up some of the activities starting this week and then, you know, a little bit at a time, while at the same time continuing to promote the rules that are kind of weighing on them from a mental health perspective. So, you know, it's really hard. I mean, it's hard for adults to be separated and all the rules that we're following. You know, I've been a hermit. I finally had my second vaccine. Hooray! But that doesn't mean I'm going to go out and party, right? So, it has been a challenge. We have seen some increase. I won't say that we're in any sort of dangerous situation right now. But I think it's really important for us to continue to monitor it, which we are, but then also to offer these relief valves for the students so that they can enjoy some in-person and very controlled situation. So that's where we are right now.
As far as there being 24-hour assistance for people that are in emergent care or emergent need, is there a system set up for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, telehealth is operating, and anyone that needs help can easily get it.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Shauna. Thanks, Pat. Was there anything from you, Karen? I saw you reach forward. I wasn't sure. I wanted to make sure you had a chance.
Oh, Pat's exactly right. And last week during our wellness days, we had some really great events and activities. Presented in a really responsible manner that were so well received by students who just wanted to be outside and engaged and interacting. So hopefully we can continue down that path.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And thanks everyone who's making it happen for students. Rich John?
Thank you, Leslie. Just while you guys are here, I did want to mention wearing another hat. I've been teaching in the fall and this spring, and I'm teaching a combined in-person and remote class, which creates lots of technical hurdles. And I have been continually impressed with the dedication of the IT people to support teaching on campus. It's really been impressive. And also the facilities people. The classrooms are immaculate, and the cleaning supplies are there, and every effort seems to be made to do everything possible to keep everybody as safe as possible. And I just wanted to put that out there. It's really been impressive. Thanks.
Well, thank you, and I'll be sure to pass on your comments to my colleagues who run facilities and IT. Very much appreciated, I'm sure.
Thank you, Rich. I know that when we're talking about opening up campus, our community has such concerns. We're in the height of this pandemic, and no one knew what it would look like. And you've certainly done an amazing job as a team at Cornell to try to keep our community as safe as possible. So we really do appreciate it and make sure our students are taken care of and our faculty are taken care of, et cetera. So just forecasting, what are you all predicting forecasting in terms of student enrollment? Are students coming back? Are you seeing numbers dropping off?
For this semester, we had a little bit of a drop off, and Pat could speak to specifics. But we have, you know, of a total usual population of around 23,000 students, undergrad and grad, we have an excess of 19,000 this semester, which is great. We are pleased with those numbers, and we're going to even be happier with a more robust population, hopefully this fall.
Yeah, our early numbers for we just opened up a continued occupancy, and we were. And it's really literally been, I think, one day, we were at about an 89% take rate.
Wow.
So that was good. You know, we ended up around 75% occupancy in the spring. We had hoped it would be more. It was actually more right before the winter break. But then with all the things that were happening and the rise in cases across the country, it dropped off dramatically between like December 15th and then when students finally did come back. But I think we're going to have a robust fall, and we're certainly planning for that. And, you know, that's my team. We're the logistics and planning committee to get those students back here safely and work with Cornell Health to get them tested. And, you know, there's still a lot of decisions to be made about arrival testing and how we're going to handle that in the fall versus how we handle it in the spring. So still a lot of decisions to make, but, I'm optimistic that it's going to be, I'm optimistic that it's going to be a very successful and at least close to normal semester than what we've been dealing with the last year.
Yeah, there are some unknowns, and that's what's keeping us from making decisions and announcements about the fall. But we don't know what percentage of the population will be either vaccinated or immune from having had the virus. We don't know what the prevalence of the virus and variants will look like regionally as well as around the country and around the world. So we are in a wait and see mode as we get closer and closer to having to make those types of decisions.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the optimism, Pat. We're optimistic. We want to be optimistic for our economy's sake.
So absolutely.
Thank you for all that you're doing. Hopefully you'll be able to vaccinate your students. Hopefully you'll get the go-ahead to be able to do that, because that will help tremendously. Oh, thank you. All right, Martha, I thought I had the last word, but you get the last word on it.
Just one more. How about North Campus? How's it going? And when do you think that'll open?
The North Campus residential expansion. It is on time for the first of the two components to open this August. And we're very, very excited about that. And then it'll be another year until the other component of the project to open. Unbelievable work by many, many parties, including the three municipalities involved to get us to this point. And for those who haven't had a chance to walk or drive by it, they're absolutely exquisite buildings. And we're excited to be able to name them after some of our stellar alumni.
Congratulations. That's great. Thank you all.
That is great. Well, thank you. Is there anything else from, Joel, Pat?
No.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, and an open invitation. Please let us know when you'd like us back. We'd be happy to spend more time if needed.
Well, thank you again. Thanks for spending the time with us and for coming to Tiger as well. We really do appreciate you all and all that you've been doing. Our best to President Pollack as well and the rest
thank
of
you.
The administration.
We will.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Take care. Thank you all very much. We'll go back to our agenda. We were at privilege of the floor. Yes, that's where we were. Is there any public that's still here who would like to speak to us on the privilege of the floor, or did we receive any messages to be read into the record?
No.
No. All right. Thank you, Kathy. Any municipal officials with us? Let me go to my second screen. I don't know.
I think Duxon was with us. I don't know if he's still here. I don't see him.
He might have left because they have a 7 o'clock meeting for the committee to deal with public safety.
Okay. Thank you, Henry. Nope, I don't see him either. No one else. All right. Legislators? Deborah Dawson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the privilege to attend a presentation of the Distinguished Youth Award to one of my constituents, Carolyn Verrett, a senior at Ithaca High School. She's also in the criminal justice program at the Career and Tech Center at TST BOCES and the National Honor Society, a frequent award winner for Student of the Month, high honor roll achiever. She has a part-time job at McDonald's, but still manages to fit in participation in the United States Air Force Auxiliary Civil Air Patrol. She volunteers at Loaves and Fishes and the Groton Food Pantry, and I can't understand when this child sleeps. She is just a stellar example of what good kids we're raising in Tompkins County, and I salute her.
Thank you. Congratulations. Can you say her name again?
Carolyn Verrett.
Carolyn Verrett. Congratulations, Carolyn, from all of us in the Tompkins County Legislature. On all your achievements, thank you for your service and being our distinguished youth. Thanks, Deborah. Dan Klein.
Thank you. I have three little things I want to share tonight. They're all pretty quick. The first one is that I also got to deliver a Distinguished Youth Award to a youth in Danby. Her name is Margaret Trumbull. And I want to pull out a couple of things from her nomination. I'm going to rearrange them in chronological order. She aspires to be a certified nurse midwife. She has organized a class community project at Ithaca High School where students record themselves reading children's books that they distribute to area elementary schools. Margaret is also co-class president of the New Visions program. And Margaret is also co-founder of the student organization called the Glamour Gals that goes to local nursing homes to bring joy to its residents. And what struck me about this is that she wants to be a midwife and deal with newborns, and then she's doing this program with elementary school kids, and she's class president of her high school, and she also has this program for seniors. I just thought that was remarkable that a person would be involved in so many age groups.
Thank you, Dan. Can we give a cheer for Margaret as another of our distinguished youth? Thank you very much, Margaret, for everything that you're doing as well. And we need more nurses, so good idea.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, thanks. The second thing I wanted to report is that the town of Danby just recently finished up a process where they were figuring out a land management plan for 35 acres of forest that the town owns. And I'm really glad to say that what they decided to do was to manage it for old growth. Most of you will know that I'm a fan of that idea. And so basically the plan is as much as possible just to leave it alone and let the forest mature on its own into old growth forest. And the last thing I wanted to share was something from the Ithaca Times this week. It's a once a month column by Stephen Burke. I'm just going to read you a few sentences. In most places, you would rather eat a broom than go to the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's different here in Ithaca. Here, the DMV is no paperwork purgatory, but a paragon of efficiency that proves brisk bureaucracy can be a real thing, not an oxymoronic joke. It's a similar situation now with a new bureaucracy here that doesn't act like one. Our COVID-19 mass vaccination clinic. And then he goes on to talk about his experience when he went up to the mall to get his vaccination. So I just wanted to, you know, mention that here, mentions the DMV, which is a county function, and the vaccination clinic, which we, you know, have something to do with consulting on at least, and that we got called out in a local column. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It's good to be called out for good things.
Yes.
Oh, thank you for sharing all of those. Martha.
Thank you very much. Congrats on all, ditto on all that good stuff. That's great. Some updates on some of the lobbying efforts, and we keep hearing more and more about the federal American Rescue Plan that was signed into law. And this one I emailed, but I want to make sure Jason heard that the FFCRA, the family, I don't even know what that stands for. It's about the public about leave for paying leave for our employees, and that in this new bill, governments, local governments, are eligible for the tax credits, to receive the federal tax credit for wages or compensation paid to employees under FFCRA. So Jason's been asking for that for a while, and Chuck Schumer listened this time. So got it in. There are a lot of FMAP, new FMAP provisions for Medicaid. There's another $21.6 billion in national emergency rental assistance as well. And we keep nagging the state to try to find out exactly how that's going to get administered. Kit Kephart from DSS has been giving us a lot of help in what to ask for. So, and the National Association of Counties has sent around a lot of information to urge people to go and look. There's really a lot that's available, and some of it needs to be applied for. So people should, and agencies should be looking for that information. This last week, NYSAC had two lobby days where they set up a lot of meetings with different committees, and a number of you were on some of those meetings. We did get a commitment that NYSAC will, on the public safety civil service reforms that we were looking for, these were discussed at the public safety committee meeting, and NYSAC is going to work with the Sheriff's Association to write legislation, and they want to, and thanks very much to Jonathan Wood for joining on that meeting and very eloquently explaining some of the challenges we've had. So that was good news. And Ryan Gregoire, who has been our main legislative contact at NYSAC, reported that they're pretty confident that the AIM cost shift in our sales tax will be reversed in this budget. And he actually said thanks to Deborah Dawson in that Tax and Finance Committee meeting that you made a great case. So,
thanks.
Yep, absolutely. So those lobbying efforts have been really were really helpful. And then just one other thing is to the value of NACO, the National Association of Counties. Some of us have been on a number of meetings that they've got the legislative conference going on now, also virtual. And I heard a presentation last week about changes that the Office of Management and Budget on January 19th, the last day of the prior administration, OMB was proposed a number of changes to how metropolitan areas are defined. That's the designation that gives us an MPO, gives us the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which funds the Transportation Council, fully funds through the federal government, as well as brings in significant highway dollars. So we found out, it was made clear that there are some real problems there. Deborah Dawson also heard wind of this from another source. So I really appreciate that our planning department and Fernando de Aragon are working on comments. The city has put together comments as well. But the comment period ends Friday. So this is something that kind of really was heightened by the meeting at NACO, and really appreciate people chipping in. But if you hear about this, it's actually one of those urgent kind of crisis problems that could affect federal funding in a variety, a whole range of areas. So we will be working on that this week to make sure we get everything covered in the comments. And, I mean, the Spell City and Chuck Schumer's office is aware, and I'll be sending her our comments too. So just one of the benefits of the NACO membership was all the information we got out of that on that issue. So a lot of stuff, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Ann Corman, Rich John, Deborah Dawson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First off, I want to say that I am express my disgust and my sorrow in the some of the events that happened on the Commons of Ithaca this weekend, in particular the burning of the Antifa, the Black Lives Matter, and the flag of China. The also there were racist and transphobic comments that were spewed by speakers. So I just want to say in the strongest words possible that I'm sorry that this happened. This does not, I want to say to the community, this does not represent the majority of the people in Tompkins County. It does not represent me. I also just wanted to follow up on what Dan, I believe it was Dan, that said something about that for the vaccine site at the mall that the county is at least consulting. To my knowledge, we are doing quite a lot at the COVID vaccination site and working in partnership with Cayuga Health, including process of the vaccine registry, but also some staffing and coordination. So if, and I think this has been unclear possibly to the community, and I, it's not a criticism. I really want, you know, the emergency operations committee, the health department administration to keep just doing the work that you're doing. But if you're doing a presentation, if you could just elaborate a little bit more to explain what you're doing to give yourself credit, but just so that people know. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ann. Rich John, then Deb Dawson.
Thank you, Leslie. I just wanted to note that we are a legislature of 13 tonight, and that there is a special election to fill the seat vacated by Anna Kellis that'll be held next Tuesday. And if you are a voter in District 2, please help us fill our ranks here, and I hope you're planning to go out and vote. It would be very nice for us to get back up to 14. So just wanted to put a reminder out there. Thanks.
Very good, Rich. Thank you for that. Yes, indeed. Deb Dawson and then Mike Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more a question than a comment. Martha commented that counties are now eligible for a tax credit for family-friendly leave, and I wasn't aware that the county paid taxes, so if somebody can explain to me how that tax credit is valuable, I would be very grateful.
I don't know that either, Deborah. I just know that Jason cared about it, so I don't know. Maybe Jason can explain.
I don't know, but we're going to find out.
Okay.
There you go.
Good.
And if we pay taxes, we're going to get money for it.
Okay. If you say so.
All right. Mike Lean.
I can't help but be cognizant of what's going on in Albany. The charges against the public complaint, let's say, against Governor Cuomo. As an attorney, I was trained in issues having to do with law and criminal law, particularly that a person is innocent until proven guilty. I don't believe in convicting people on statements made to the press. I hope that this does not hamstring our government, particularly during the COVID crisis. I hope that the allegations are properly investigated, and if they are accurate, and if there is has been a violation of law or ethics, that the governor is held accountable. But let's not convict someone on a one-sided hearing of things at this point. I sort of appreciated President Biden's reaction in this matter. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for acknowledging that as well. Is there anyone else? Yes, Martha.
Yeah, Jennifer Tavares, thank you, Jennifer, wrote that you pay the same taxes that other employees do. So that must be payroll, various payroll taxes, I guess. Thank you, Jennifer. And can somebody remind us what the early voting procedures are for the District 2? And the time, the polls on Tuesday are open, I guess, 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Is that right? Does anybody know?
I see Mike's.
I'm almost thinking because it's a special election at noon to 9, but I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
If any of our election commissioners are watching us, please send us that information.
I forgot to mention, and everyone should be aware, that even though we have that special election next week, tonight, the village elections are going on. Mm-hmm. And anyone who hasn't had a chance to get out there, those polls are open until 9 p.m. in our villages that have elections. Please go out and vote.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to just quickly mention to you all, just a reminder, another fundraiser coming up this Friday for United Way. United Way's Wine and Dine from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. in conjunction with Cayuga Radio Group. United Way has been doing amazing things in our community, especially last year and into this year, with trying to support families who have been hard hit by COVID-19. So we do want to encourage you to support United Way's fundraisers as they continue to be a great resource and financial support to counties. Martha.
Yeah, sorry to belabor this, but just check the Board of Elections website. For District 2, the early voting location is at the Board of Elections, 128 East Buffalo Street. And basically it's 9 a.m. People should look at that website, but it's mostly 9 to 5 through this coming Sunday. And on Tuesday, it's 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., the voting. Thank you.
Thank you for checking that, Martha, and letting people know. We appreciate it. All right. Thank you, legislators. Rich?
Just, I went to the Board of Elections site as well. On polling day, on the 23rd, it's at Tabernacle Baptist Church at 1019 North Cayuga Street, not the Board of Elections to vote. So early voting at the Board of Elections and then the Tabernacle Baptist Church on election day.
And this is for District 2.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. We are going to try and move on to the rest of our agenda. I hope I'm not missing anybody. Is there any staff here who's waiting for anything? No, I don't see anyone. Let's move on to, oh boy, reports from county administrator, county attorney, and finance director. I'm looking at the time and yeah, let's go there. County administrator Jason Molino.
Evening, everyone.
Evening.
I thought I would come up and annoy the folks at the EOC today for this evening's meeting. So, but I give the report and presentation up here today. Just want to, before I start, thank everyone for their commitment and dedication. You know, this past week, marked a year, an important year of working at this pandemic response, and want to thank the legislature for their support as we've gone through this together. Really, you know, the good work of the folks in this room and the folks at the health department and our entire county response is because you've given the confidence and trust in us to do our job. So we greatly appreciate that. We appreciate you having your confidence in us and giving us the resources to serve the community. So thank you very much. We appreciate it. And believe it or not, that this is this slide deck that I'll put up here right now. Let me share my screen with you. As you've seen many times before, it's gone full circle now. Here we are with, let's see if I can get this up here. I don't know, it's probably close to 200 slides, Don.
Yes.
Something like that. 200 slides. You can see we started at the beginning of April, which covered the first really 4 weeks of the response, or first 3 weeks of the response, and here we are going full circle of a complete year of operations. I think happy to say that hospitalizations are down, and that, you know, our active caseload is slowly continuing to go down, which we want to continue to see. It fluctuates from day to day. Some days we're down into the teens of new cases. Today, I think we were up above 20 or 22. So, you know, we've seen it dip as low as into the single digits. It's not consistent yet, but we're hoping that it's heading in the right direction, and we want to see that continue to get into single digits and stay in single digits as we go forward. But we're just not there yet. I think the exciting thing is the amount of first doses that we've administered here in the county. I'd be happy to have Frank talk a little bit more about what's going on at the vaccination site if some folks want to ask some more specific questions, and what else is happening to vaccinate other members of the community. There's a slide later on. I'll show you where we compare in the southern tier, which I think you'll be pleasantly pleasant to see where we are with our colleague counties that are in the southern tier. You know, I'm not going to go through this word by word, but a lot of approaches. The RBUS TC transportation team was able to provide rides for folks to the Binghamton vaccination site, which we think is good. We'll continue to monitor activity, and then we'll report on that maybe after the first 2 or 3 weeks or so to give you an update. But folks are using it. Gadabout's getting some use as well. So some of the transportation mechanisms we put in place are starting to be used, which is good to see, getting people to the vaccination site. A lot of changes over the 2 weeks, really starting to open up different subgroups, the ability to get vaccinated. And what we're starting to see, unlike maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, is that as we open up to these other groups, they're not filling up as quickly, which is a sign that a lot of people are getting vaccinated that want to get vaccinated, which is good. We want to continue to have that issue. We also want to continue to educate, continue to encourage folks to get vaccinated, understand the efficacy of the vaccine, and have any folks that are undecided to come and get the vaccine as it becomes available, which is good. Here is a little bit of a similar, as you see, the number of hours we spent, the amount of time, regular hours, overtime hours, compensation time. Again, the amount of different types of leave. To Martha's point earlier, I know Lisa and Ruby just met with them today. They're going to start to look into what this new bill means for us, both short-term, long-term, what continues, what doesn't continue, and how that'll impact our workforce and where we want to go with that. So hopefully in the next week or two, we'll start to have a better understanding of what's in the bill and what that means short-term, long-term. Continue to do regular testing, and I think continuing to do well over 5,000 tests a week at the site, which is still good to see and good resources for folks to use. Here's a new poster that's been put together by the PIO team, you know, putting out some different community messaging, encouraging folks to get vaccinated, continuing to maintain the vigilance as we go through this. I want to continue to stress, regardless of whether you're vaccinated, still take the precautions and continue to encourage other folks to take the precautions until we get into a safer space and minimal new cases, and we're able to see those numbers continue to decrease. Here's a little comparison of some of the southern tier counties. Not surprising, we're leading all the counties in our region with respect to the percentage of population vaccinated, 27%. Of course, Broome County has the state mass site in their county, correct?
Yes.
Obviously, we have our mass site that's been up and running before any of the state sites. Continues to function well up the Sears building in the mall. But this is just shows you where we're faring with some of the regional counties. Southern Tier continues to fare well, I think, with perspective of low positivity rates across the state, good vaccination rates across the state regions, and continues to show low or higher hospital capacities available. So the state puts out those metrics, I think, every week or every few days, and we continue to be of the top regions in the state, which is good to see. I think that's it. I think that's all we have today. Again, narrative is changing a little bit, and that is we continue to expand the vaccination, expand the criteria, not necessarily expand the criteria, but expand it to more folks that are eligible for it, continue to work on getting folks signed up as quickly as they can. The registry is coming very helpful, being able to reach out to folks, communicate with them, trying to identify barriers and eliminating those barriers to get folks to the vaccination site. So definitely different narrative than it was 4 weeks ago, but nonetheless, still uncertainty. You know, we're reading probably the same you are with the potential of another surge of positive cases as weather gets better, interest of folks to gather, strong encouragement from the CDC continuing to maintain vigilance, not to relax on some of the protective measures that we've been in place for the past year. We continue to promote that. We continue to say we're not in the clear. We want to continue to see folks take the right precautions so that we don't surge in the community. We can avoid it at all stakes and continue to see this positive trend downward of positive cases so that it becomes minimal and that the continued upward trend of more folks getting vaccinated. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Jason. I want to circle back to a question that Annie had. It wasn't a question, but a suggestion as part of the report. If you don't mind sharing how we are collaborating with CHS on the vaccine clinic in terms of staffing and so on.
I think maybe I'll have Frank step in and maybe share a little bit.
Sure. So it's a joint effort between the county and CHS. The bulk of the staff there come from CHS, and they are handling the day-to-day operations of the site. We do offer three non-clinical staff for every day they're operational, and we have been backfilling with nurses as we've had availability to support with vaccination. I also do all of the scheduling for first doses, so we're still maintaining the creation of those first dose schedules, the publishing of them, and really determining the distribution within the doses that we get. Once on site, the CAGA takes over, and they are responsible for the second dose scheduling for the individuals that are there. So it's really a joint effort. I think from a staffing perspective, the majority of it is CHS. But I think from an operational planning perspective, we have shared responsibilities.
Thank you. Other legislators, Mike Lane.
Saw the press release today that we're getting another number of doses for the 1A and 1B. Do we have any idea what percentage of the 1A and 1B in the county have been vaccinated?
Yeah, we don't really know, Mike, because we don't know the denominator. We don't know how many people are in many of those groups. What we do know anecdotally, as Jason was describing, as we're putting links out, it's taking longer for those to get filled up. We are communicating directly with people rather than through their employers now, so we're hoping that that's helping reach more individuals. But we don't yet know for certain. In those groups. Obviously, there are some that just opened up this week, and so we're just now giving them their first opportunity. But we continually monitor the registry, and we're going to keep reaching out to those folks as long as there are people still interested.
Thank you.
Thank you. Henry, Shauna, Martha, Mike Sigler.
Yes, thanks for the presentation. And I noticed that you said the New York State has 27,000 of our residents who received the first dose, and 14,000 of those have been done in Tompkins County.
It's closer to 17,000 that we've done here.
Okay. Okay, but that, but the 27 is the state total.
For our county, yes. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I don't remember what order I said. Shauna, Martha, Mike Sigler.
Yeah, I actually signed up for the registry one of the first days it started and ended up getting my vaccine last Thursday. It took 27 minutes from me walking in the door to walking out of the door, and it was absolutely flawless. Didn't have any symptoms after the injection, and everyone was excited to be there. The people working there were incredible. Wonderful experience. So kudos to Cuga Health Partners, our the volunteers that are working there, and then obviously our staff that are working there as well. I did have a question in regards to the different variants, and wanted to ask if we've seen any more of the UK variant in Tompkins.
Yeah, we have seen additional B118. We've also Cornell has also been able to identify a handful of the others as well. I think where we're at with the variants is they're pretty much ubiquitous now across the country, and we're not surprised to see the additional variants appearing here locally. I think the important thing for us to remember is that it doesn't change what we need to do, right? We need to get vaccinated, and we need to continue to follow the public health guidance until we have that herd immunity, which hopefully will help us with any variants that might be.
And so just to confirm, the vaccine is covering the current variants that are in our community?
Well, the science is still out on what impacts the vaccine will have on all of the different variants. What we do know is it is very effective against the original variant of COVID, and that is still the most predominant that we have. Obviously, they're working and doing research to try to figure out about the other variants as well, and time will give us more information on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Martha, Mike Sigler.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, for Jason and Dominic back there. Do we have any the pop-up that you did at BGM and BGM GEC, you said it was very successful. Do you have like a roster of where you will do the next pop-up? Do you have those kind of plans lined up?
We definitely have plans on potential locations. We haven't made any final decisions yet on what will be next. What I will tell you is we're still in the process of doing the senior housing. So we'll be out in Groton with our mobile units on Thursday doing a couple of facilities out there. And then we also have to begin next week second doses on the first senior facilities that we did at Titus and McGraw. So we're working on that. We're also putting the homebound plan together. It's starting to come along. We have over 100 folks registered. What we don't have is Johnson & Johnson vaccine yet to be able to implement. So as soon as we have that, we'll be ready to go to move on the homebound folks. I think after those kind of initiatives have been, I don't want to say completed because they're not going to be completed, but I've had some substantial attention and supply continues to grow, then we would be looking to go out to more pop-up sites, for lack of a better way of describing them.
Okay, because I know we talked about it a little bit after the BGM, because I would like to, I had also a similar terrific experience at Sears at the mall site when I got my first dose, and because everybody kept moving, you didn't stay stuck in any one place for at all, so it really went smoothly. But I was really disturbed at I saw almost nobody of color in among, I don't know, at least 100 people in the room. And I, do you have any sense of are we reaching the diversity of our community?
Yeah, we're not there. We're not where we would want to be as far as comparison to the actual population. We're starting out a little behind because the initial populations we were able to vaccinate were employment based, and so you know that there's not a straight one-to-one comparison across the demographics based on the different professions. So it's a little challenging to draw any specific conclusions, but I think your assessment is a fair one. And I think we absolutely have work to do in our communities of color and our rural communities, for that matter, to make access, to make the vaccine accessible.
So I really appreciate that. And as far as the homebound, I've written to you about the doctor's offices being able to, maybe they can help where they've got, I mean, my own physician said they do routine care to the, that they take care to the homebound, their homebound clients. So maybe the physician's offices can help with some of those deliveries.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Mike Sigler.
Frank, I apologize if you already talked about this, but a new study came out this week that said, 3 feet apart can probably be done safely with kids. I know the CDC is reviewing that guidance now. That's kind of a game changer for the school districts. I didn't know. Are we prepared if the CDC comes down with that guidance? That's a pretty big change. Are we prepared for that kind of change?
Are we or are the school districts? I think that's probably the bigger question. So we've been talking with the districts about this for the last couple of weeks. The state guidance that was issued for last fall does allow for less than 6 feet if an impermeable barrier is constructed. So that is really what we're starting to see across New York State is that different districts are going back to that original guidance and saying, okay, well, we're going to try to bring more kids back and we're going to have these barriers in place. The challenge is there isn't more direction from the state on that, and we're not really in a position to contradict state guidance and provide something different than what is included in that. So I think the districts are in the process of evaluating what makes sense for their community. It obviously would be costly in a lot of instances to have to make barriers. I think there's 9 weeks of school left. So there's some thought about whether it makes sense to just start fresh in the fall. I think they're going through all of those mechanisms now to see what makes sense for each district. And I don't think it's going to be consistent across the county. I think different districts are going to make different decisions based on what's best for their community.
It's my understanding that's 3 feet without barriers. That's 3 feet just if the kids wear masks that the CDC is studying right now.
Yeah, and if that guidance, if that was to come out and the state was to adopt it, that would be great, and certainly we would be in supportive of that. The challenge right now is the state guidance that they have to follow. It doesn't say anything about foot distance. It just says if it's under 6 feet, there has to be a barrier. So if that were to change, we would certainly be supportive of that, but it would need to change before our districts would be able to go forward with it.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Frank.
Yep. All right. Thank you. Good question, Mike. Henry.
Yes, Frank, I want to follow up on the variant question. I know we used to get notices about every time there was a variant found. Are we stopped that process?
Yeah, there's just been a lot of other public information activities that we've been trying to focus on. The variants are out there. As I said, they're fairly ubiquitous throughout the country at this point. So reporting on every instance of finding it wasn't something that we prioritized. I'd also point out part of the only reason we know is because Cornell has the capability and is partnering with Cuyahoga Health Systems to do some of that additional testing. I would imagine other communities don't have that same access and probably don't have that data at their fingertips.
Do you have a sense of how many positive cases come from the variants?
I don't know it off the top of my head, Henry. We can certainly look into it and follow up with you.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you all for the report. Thank you, Frank, and thanks, everyone, for the questions. You know, the thing I do want us to focus on, you know, as a body is to continue to push the message about vaccination, trying to encourage people to get their vaccines, as well as the guidance around distancing and so on. You know, I want to, you know, share a little bit because Henry, you had asked about the pop-up site at GIAC, that I think it was successful, because, you know, there was that element of comfort and familiarity for a lot of folks. Matter of fact, I spoke to a lady a couple of nights ago, as we were calling, you know, a couple last week, as a GIAC, we were calling people to remind them, you know, those who had gotten their first shot, you know, just reminded them to go for the second shots. Everybody was ready. You know, we'd call and they're telling us what their time was. And they were just excited to be able to, they turned it into a little mini reunion. I don't know if the folks who work there experienced the same thing, but she was complaining that she had brought her mom. And mom just kept greeting everybody. You know, darling, I haven't seen you in such a long time. And everybody was just happy to connect because it had been such a long time. I knew I went over there just to check in to see how things were going. And I was there for probably 2 hours. You know, same thing. People just, you know, felt comfortable. It was a space they knew, et cetera, et cetera. Sean, I wish 27 minutes. I mean, I guess I must talk too much. It was my time. It's fun going to the mall, but same thing. I run into a lot of people. People want to say hello. Oh, you're getting your vaccine too? It just turned into a big old party. So continue to push the message. That's what we really should be focusing on in terms of people getting vaccines, keeping safe, et cetera. That would help tremendously. And thanks again to the folks in the EOC. Thank you, Jason, Frank, for your leadership. It's been a year, and it's been a year of challenges and triumphs in some respects. And we couldn't have done it without all of us working together. So thank you so very kindly. Before we take a quick break, I skipped over announcing that we'll have a quick executive session tonight to discuss real estate negotiations as well as a personnel matter related to a particular person. The other thing that I wanted to very quickly share with you all from Mr. Beebe's family, who didn't join us to accept the proclamation, that they wanted, his wife wrote to say, I watched the proceedings and heard you read about my husband's accomplishments. Thank you so much. He would have been so proud to know that what he did mattered enough to gain formal recognition by his hometown. I look forward to receiving the copy of the proclamation from you. So I just wanted to share her note of thanks to all of us for recognizing his accomplishments. Thank you. Why don't we, it's 7:35, why don't we take a quick break, 10 minutes. 7:45, we'll return and continue our reports. Thank you. All right. Resuming the meeting, the March 16th, 2021 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. After our break, let's move on with the reports from County Attorney. Jonathan, do you have anything for us tonight?
Just very briefly, I wanted everybody to know I plan to retire in December. I've been here more than 28 years, had the pleasure of serving the county for that long, and I think it's just time for me to move on. And that's my report.
I'm rewinding, and you're going to start over because that was not acceptable. I don't know who gave you permission to retire. I'm pressing the rewind button because you did not say that. Jonathan, thank you so much for letting us know. Wow, 28 years. That's a very long time. Thank you.
It is.
I don't even know what more to say at this point, but we certainly do really appreciate you.
I don't know how you're not bored to death 28 years in the same job.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the plain truth is that this job, there are so many different things that you do. I mean, you know, we have so many different departments and so many different things that it's, you know, I think the same thing about most law jobs, though. I do.
We'll miss you.
Well, it wasn't boring because he spent 20 of those 28 years with me. What can I say? I just bring the party.
The first
Jonathan,
thing
go ahead. Back me up on that, Jonathan. Go ahead. Martha.
And me. I was here for the same.
Oh, there you go.
So, Jonathan, that's doesn't seem possible. I remember when people who I thought were my age started retiring, and it's like, that really felt weird. But I know you're not my age, but thank you for everything. For everything, you know, it's a job that's complex and nuanced, and I know that, you know, there's a whole lot behind the scenes that nobody ever knows about. Thank goodness. So you've really been a public servant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would just like to put in a plug that we ramp up a search process as soon as possible. I would love to see as much overlap as we could possibly get with a new person. And we've all had the unfortunate experience of sometimes you run a whole search and you don't get the person you want the first time. So I really, just not being, no one be pessimistic, but realistic, I hope we can set a process in place, right away. So thank you, Jonathan. Thanks for giving us this much notice.
Sure thing.
Thank you. Mike Lane?
Yes, John, that's not comforting news, let's put it that way.
No.
But we certainly understand, and we appreciate the fact that you've been here with us, and we look forward to working with you through the end of the year, too. But I would like to say that I hope in our process of finding a replacement that we do similar to what we did with Jonathan, and that is have a bipartisan or nonpartisan selection process. John was the first county attorney who was appointed not on a political basis. And I think it has served the county well to have someone in that position who isn't a Democrat or Republican, for example. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike Lane, and thank you for that history. I didn't know that. Henry Granison.
Yes. So we have retirement parties for Leslie Bean Claiborne, Martha Robertson, Jonathan Wood, Glenn Murray, Dave McKenna. Anybody else going to retire?
Henry, don't tempt them. All the party animals.
Okay.
I hear you. All the party animals are leaving. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yes, well, we're going to
have Dale Hall.
Yeah. Sudell Hall is also retiring. Yeah, we're gonna have a fun December. Hopefully, we'll be COVID free.
You never know. Thank you for that. All right, Finance Director Rick Schneider, do you have anything for us?
Well, my wife told me to tell you whatever Jonathan says, but I don't think. But he usually says no report.
I was just about to press the mute button on you, but go ahead.
Well, I'm not going to say what Jonathan said. No. That's what I guess. But I do have no report. Drew wanted me to let you know that we're buried in audits. We are buried in journal entries and it's working our way out. As I said last time, we just finished the task audit. We had Leslin and Jason there at our annual task. That's our Tobacco Asset Securitization Corporation audit. We had that annual meeting yesterday, so we're past that. We have our final IDA acceptance of audit meeting this week. So that's two down. We're working on the consortium audit right now and the year-end report. Our auditors will be here, or they won't be here, but they will be field auditing remotely starting next Monday for the consortium. So we're right in line about where we should be, but I have nothing else really to report to you this evening. That's it.
Thank you. Henry, you have a question for Rick?
Yes, I noticed that the controller said that we were down 8.7% in sales tax for 8.1% for February and January. Does that sound right?
I can't confirm that right now because we're behind on both January and February receipts. I hope to bring that to you next time.
Okay.
We kind of got dislodged due to all the year-end and audit work. I hope to bring that to you at our next meeting. So I can't really confirm that tonight.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome.
Any other county staff who needed to share anything with us? I didn't see anybody. All right, let's move on to our consent agenda. No, actually, are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn?
I think we have an appointment. I think we have an appointment that was going to be added to the agenda. It was sent out for the Human Rights Commission.
Yes, that's right. So we need to add this appointment. It's coming out of, is it out of HHS?
Yes.
Donna, you have an appointment to add?
Yes, if I could add Joanna Green for the Human Rights Commission, please.
List of appointments. Okay, do we have to have a formal motion to add it, Kathy?
Yes, we need to have a second, and then I'll do a roll call.
Okay. Seconded by Ann Corman. Vote on adding this appointment to the appointments list.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslin McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries. Thank you very much. And all these appointments, Kathy, are on our advisory board appointments are on our consent agenda, correct?
Correct.
All right. So let's take up our consent agenda. These are resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of the standing or special committee. Let's start with our advisory board appointments. From Government Operations Committee to the Public Information Advisory Board, Lucas Smith. From the Housing and Economic Development Committee, to the Community Housing Development Fund, Anne Corman as the appointee and Henry Granison as the alternate. From the Health and Human Services Committee to the Developmental Disabilities Subcommittee, Allison Weiner-Heinemann and Adrian Lamb, and to the Tompkins County Human Rights Commission, Joanna Green. Those are all the appointments. Resolutions from Government Operations Committee authorizing a public hearing on Local Law B of 2021, a local law amending Chapter 80 of the county code and repealing Article 30.04 of the county charter to allow for merging of the Stop DWI and Traffic Safety Committees, ID 9914. From Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Resolution B, Adjustment to the 2021 Budget, City County Sales Tax Distribution Agreement, ID 9972. From the Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution C, Authorizing Submittal of 2021 New York State Homes and Community Renewal Housing Trust Fund Corporation Community Development Block Grant Request for Micro Enterprise Development Funding, ID 9968. May I have someone move the consent agenda, please? Moved by Amanda Champion. I second. Deborah Dawson seconds. Thank you very much. Let's vote on the consent agenda.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries unanimously. On to the Special and Standing Committee reports. Starting with Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
I was actually not in attendance at our meeting, so if I could defer to Henry Granison, Vice Chair.
Henry Granison, Vice Chair.
Sure. We met yesterday. We had department updates on each of the departments. We also, we also passed the advisory board appointments. And we had a presentation by Frank Cooper where he answered many questions about the COVID and the vaccination process, which he sort of answered today. And I guess that was about it.
All right. Thank you, Henry. Any questions? Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
The Facilities Committee will meet on Thursday morning at 9 o'clock a.m. We haven't had a meeting since our last legislature meeting. Might mention that I did attend the ITCTC Planning Committee meeting this morning. That's the Ithaca-Tompkins County Transportation Council. And the topic that Martha spoke about was discussed, and that is the potential change under the census recommendation of our MPO. We're one of the smallest MPOs. There are five MPOs that are at risk in upstate New York, and the census change would change us from a sort of a metropolitan area, I think the terminology was, to a micropolitan. And what that could mean is loss of targeted funds for not only the highways and bridges that we have, but also mass transit and other things. Dwight Mengel was there and mentioned that we could lose almost $3 million in transit aid that he was aware of. This was something that was brought about very late in the process of the census by the Trump administration. Let's hope that that does not continue to go through. They also, from the New York State, they updated us on the Route 34B bridge in Lansing, which, by the way, as they said, was 550 feet long. It's not a little one, as we know. And it was removed, and the contractor is well on schedule, including beginning to pour the foundation concrete, and they've ordered the steel for it, or whatever the pressed concrete or whatever they'll be using for beams, I don't know. Tim Loeb from the city mentioned that there are a number of projects that will be going on in the city streets, including some new signals on North Cuba Street, and they'll be repaving the area of Elmira Road down around the Home Depot area, which is the city responsibility. DOT is asking that the city consider doing paving at night on that project. He also mentioned that the Green Street ramp will close on March 29th, and they'll begin demolition of part of that. Of course, that's where the convention center and other projects are going down there. The six culverts that the state awarded us funding for have now been gone through the state DOT project to approve those culverts. And they probably will be more expensive than had originally planned, but some of them have to be larger than originally thought. So that may happen for us. So I thought you might like to report on what was going on at the Transportation Council.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for that. That's good information to have. Martha.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. Mike, thanks for the report on the MPO. So do you know whether Dwight is going to put in some comments to the federal?
I think he was feeding his comments into Fernando and Katie Borghella, Director of Planning. And also, as you said earlier, which was correct, the city is also planning to put in comments on this. So I don't know if he's going to do separate comments, but we could check with him.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Because if I can kind of package all of it and send it to Amanda Spellacy, that might help. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike. Any other questions for Mike? All right. Tom Pensino, Governmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. We met on March 9th. That was our last meeting. Our next meeting is April 13th, Tuesday at 10:30. We had, as usual, reports from Diane Miller and Charlie Krasanski, a lively conversation, and then Ryan Gregoire from NYSEC came on as well, and they were all, I mean, it's really great to have all of them talking to each other. We talked about our goals for kind of what we want to talk about with our state delegation, and as you know from the emails I've sent around, we have meetings now set up with our three senators and with Anna Kellis, and Assemblywoman. And aside from the text, I'm sure everybody else is still getting from Anna. So the first meeting is this Friday with Senator O'Mara at 1:30. And I would really urge everybody to check your calendars. I won't read all the times out now, but it's always helpful if I can email the lawmaker who's going to be on the call. It just helps us all of us know how to plan the conversation. So if you can tell you what, even if you've already told me you're going to come to these, which meetings you can come to, please send me a renewed note so that I have everybody's, so I have it correct of who's coming to which meeting. And I've sent out the list of topics that, we propose to cover. So if there are no questions, that's the news from Tiger.
Thank you. Any questions for Martha? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Martha. And Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Great. Thank you, Leslyn. We met on March 4th, which seems like a long time ago now. We had a good report from Maureen Reynolds, who is our county clerk. She gave us some updates on how the DMV is running, which, as we all know, is wonderful. And how her office is running, and just some sort of updates about that. We also had a report from Jay Franklin, Director of Assessment, who gave us kind of a yearly report on what's going on in their department. As you probably know, Jay has been spending a lot of his time at the Emergency Operations Center, but he still has a foot in his department, but was very grateful to his staff for keeping the department going in a great way. We also had our final, we went through our final section of the rules of the legislature for a discussion. We didn't vote on it. This would be rules 13 through 18. And I'm pretty sure there was nothing very controversial. It was a very short discussion. We are going to vote on that at our next meeting, which I don't have my calendar in front of me, but it's the first Thursday of the month. And after we vote on that, it will come to the legislature. So that will be our last like main discussion of the rules. There will be some other cleanup things that we'll need to go back through that folks have brought up throughout all these discussions. And we also want to make sure everything in the rules conforms with what's in the charter, and that nothing that we've changed, you know, we need to then go change the charter. So we're going to work with Jonathan Wood on that and just make sure everything is in alignment. And then we will happily say we have fully edited the rules of the legislature. So I'm looking forward to that day. So that's my report.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Yeah, boy, Amanda, not controversial.
Well,
any questions?
Some controversy, but you know.
Any questions for Amanda? All right. Amanda, I have a quick question for you. Thank you for sharing with us what our poet laureate has been up to. I don't know how poets come up with their inspiration, but I was thinking about our, the 1 year anniversary of, I want to call it an anniversary, the 1 year of, COVID hitting and us shutting down. I was thinking of the proclamation tonight of the number of people whose lives have been lost to this, and just wondered if, our poet laureate, if you might communicate with her about doing something of hope for us just in light of all of that.
Yeah, that'd be great. And actually, I was thinking earlier with all the proclamations, April is National Poetry Month. And
look at that.
So I will send off an email and see if sometime in April she can join us.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you very much. That would be great. All right. Planning, Energy, and Environment, the Quality Committee, Ann Corman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did not meet since our last meeting, but we are scheduled to meet again next Monday, March 22nd at 1:30. And on our schedule, or on our agenda so far, we have the Chief Sustainability Officer budget and position transfer resolution. And so if folks want to read a little bit about that, but basically what that is changing where the position is going to be. Instead of an administration, it would be under the Department of Planning. And so please come to the PEAK meeting on Monday at 1:30 if you want to hear us discuss how that came to be and about how that will be happening. The another resolution we're having is acceptance of snowmobile grant, which is a pass-through. And also on the agenda, we're going to have the draft Tompkins County Hazard Mitigation Plan and presentation by Scott from Planning. So please come and listen to that. That hopefully was of interest to everybody here. So that's Monday at 1:30. We're also going to, also on the agenda is a discussion of a resolution. So it's not something we're going to look at adopting or passing right then, but it's a discussion of a resolution that legislator Dan Klein drafted for us regarding a forest policy. And I'll just say quickly what it basically what that does is it looks at preserving the forest, the county forest for old growth. And so, Deborah, did you want to add anything, my vice chair?
No, thanks, Anne. You got it all.
Okay. And all right. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Any questions? All right. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met last Monday. And before I give you the highlights of that meeting, I did want to touch on this OMB statistical change that's under discussion. I was specifically concerned with how that might impact TCAT, because the assistance that TCAT gets from the federal government under sections 5307 and 5311 are major for it. However, Scott Vanderpool sent me a publication from the Community Transportation Association of America that indicates that the fundamentals of federal transportation law for aid under both the Federal Transportation Act and the Federal Highway Act will continue to require that all census-defined urban areas with populations greater than 50,000, which I think covers us no matter what, will continue to get their aid and will continue to have properly designated MPOs. So that's the good news. The main item of interest from our meeting last week at BCP was a presentation from TC3 about where the college is now with its budget post-pandemic. Basically, given the assistance that will be coming to the state and to the colleges under the federal stimulus bill that was just passed, the college is going to be fine for the next year or two. However, looking forward into the future, there have been some pretty substantial changes to their market, as they call it, which bid fair to be more or less permanent trends. They noted that with COVID, the college's net tuition revenue has been significantly impacted. The college has lost 2/3 of its full-time degree-seeking residential students and fully 1/3 of its full-time FTEs. And that means that they've lost 25% of the FTEs on which the state aid is based. The part-time student population is growing, and it seems to suggest a greater need for workforce development programs because they seem to have more part-time working adults who are seeking, workforce training, micro-credentials of some sort. So the college is assessing its opportunities to invest in career seekers, assessing its marketing and enrollment processes to reflect the changes in its student body, and looking at what its opportunities are realistically to revive its residential student program. They asked that the legislatures of both Tompkins and Cortland County provide input to them on what changes we would like to see and how they operate. I commend the PowerPoint presentation that they submitted to your attention. If it's not in the agenda packet, just let me know, and I'll be glad to send it to everyone. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Deborah. Nobody has any questions.
Oh, no.
I saw Mike Lane, Henry Grandison, Martha Robertson, and Ann Coleman.
Well, something Deborah said made me feel that maybe I ought to have a little more distressing news about this possible change of the MPO that Fernando talked to us about this morning. Our urbanized area is about 55,000 people on the last census. They're going to change the way they count the people in the urbanized area from a head count to the population per square mile per census block, which might mean that we don't have the density that we have if it's simply a per capita count of people in the urbanized area. So I don't want to pull a Paul over that, but it's still up in the air.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Henry?
Yeah, I just want to send a comment. I looked at NYSAC's summary of the one bill, or the One House Act bill, and they actually increased the amount of money going to FTEs at community colleges. I don't know how that's going to work out, but they at least put in for an increase.
Okay. Thanks, Henry. Martha?
Yeah, thanks. Another piece on the MPO. Deborah, it was the Transit Association that had that long document that says
yes.
Wasn't going to worry. I guess I'm a little more nervous. It could trigger a whole bunch of different things in ways that we don't even think might be connected. For example, I heard at the NACO meeting that Medicare reimbursements for hospitals would be affected because if you're a metropolitan region, they assume your labor rates are higher than if you're a micropolitan region. So if we get bumped down to the micropolitan category, of all things, the Medicare rates that the hospital gets could drop. And I've got something in my inbox from Jennifer Tavares from the Chambers of Commerce. So I think people are talking about it. I hope that we really can at least get a slowdown of how this is implemented. And there are complicated ways this is related to the census. Fernando also pointed out he in particular is worried about whether how accurate our census data are going to be because of the pandemic in the spring when students, evacuated. So if we're only like a 5,000 person, difference before, we're only 5,000 above the threshold of 50,000, that we could really have that problem because of the census. So,
Martha, I wasn't suggesting that there aren't some potentially unfortunate consequences that could flow from this. I was just addressing the impact on TCAT's 5307 and 5311 aid. Other than that, there are some 2,500 federal aid programs that are based on the geographical statistics that come out of the census. And I would be the last person to say this is not a problem because it probably is.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anne?
Thank you. I'm just wondering with the issue, what was said, and I did watch the video from your meeting, Deborah, afterwards. But I'm just wondering at where we can tie in things that, in Martha's committee with HED, the colleges, then we have a green jobs report that's getting finalized. How we can tie all these things in, to economic recovery from the pandemic, and also, I almost said reimagining, but re-looking at, what our workforce is going to be. So I'm just wondering, how do we do that comprehensively? If anybody has any ideas or wants to talk about that.
Well, it seems to me that one place we could start is with Natalie. And Natalie has been extremely willing to consider all sorts of ideas for workforce development as part of our recovery. And I guess the one positive thing I took away from TC3's presentation last week was they seemed to be quite willing to shift things around and entertain the possibility of creating programs for micro-credentials and career seekers. They did, of course, mention the fact that their most popular career-oriented program is the nursing program, and it's also their most expensive. But you know, my feeling is if we shift those programs and make them more available to people who are career changers, for example, who are a little bit older, we might be able to recoup, or the college might be able to recoup some of those costs through assessing and collecting fees, like for laboratory use and stuff like that, which is something that most universities and colleges, even the public ones, already do.
Although, Deborah, remember, not only is it most expensive, it loses money, the nursing program.
Well, sure, because they don't collect fees.
All right.
Yeah, but it loses money.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Any other comments or questions for Deborah and Budget? All right. We'll stay tuned for Micropolitan and MPO. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Henry Grinnison, Chair.
Yes, we have not met since the last meeting. We will not be meeting until the 2 April meeting, since we've moved to an every 2 month meeting schedule. The one thing I want to note is that that Deanna and Miss Nunn from the city are working on a Juneteenth celebration. We don't know what it's going to look like yet, but I also meet with Deanna on the off months. So I'm going to meet with her on Wednesday to talk about where things are. And so that's all I want to say is that, you know, that we have a Juneteenth idea. So.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Henry?
No.
Housing and Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslie. Our last HED meeting was February 25th. Our next one will be March 25th at 9:30. And I just wrote in the chat that Annie will be looking at, bring Natalie into the meeting and really trying to figure out what are the opportunities, especially in the American Rescue Plan, that might be able to fund some workforce opportunities at TC3, funnel some money in that direction. So we're definitely going to be digging into that at HED. Another topic that we're going to dip our toe into is countywide code enforcement. This is raised by CJ Randall from the town of Lansing at a recent Planning Advisory Board meeting. And she's been giving me a lot more information. I've talked to Jason about it a little bit. And there are some real opportunities if we take a look at that. In the same way that we professionalized our assessment function in the county when we went to one countywide department, there might be some important opportunities, especially as a lot of code officers are retiring and new energy codes might be coming out of the state. There might be some important things to take a look at. So just wanted to toss that out there as a future topic for HED this year. So that's in a couple weeks.
Thank you, Martha. Any questions for Martha? One quick comment is realizing that we're all still waiting for something you said, Martha, about funneling money. I don't know if we've gotten the guidance yet from the Treasury Secretary in terms of using our Rescue Act monies, but, you know, hopefully we'll have some more involved discussion on how you know, with county administration, budget, you know, pretty much all of us, and what are the priorities for using these funds. Jason, I saw you pull up. Did you have something you wanted to add to that?
No, other than I think, you know, we've had a few meetings with NYSAC about waiting for Treasury information. I think the sense is that a lot of it's going to follow some of the existing CARES Act process or parameters since it's already in place, but nothing, you know, clear as to how that's going to work. And I know we're starting, you know, to prepare and for some of the upcoming conversations, whether it's a budget capital or personnel or HED, about what those potential uses can be. And trying to understand our own economic impact as well,
mm-hmm.
in our whole organization, aside from what the outside uses to that can be used for. So we'll also be meeting Rick and I, and probably either the treasurer's group and the administrator's group are going to meet in the next week or two with some of the larger counties that got CARES funding, talk about how they managed it, what type of records they had to keep, what's the internal workings of managing this amount of money as it's coming in so that we're prepared for it. So, you know, all those things are kind of starting to move in motion.
Fantastic. Well, we're all looking forward to being engaged.
And if I could just say, NYSAC pulled together a meeting with Senator Majority Leader Schumer, and we really, really owe a debt of gratitude to Senator Schumer, who has been a good friend for years, but he's not just been a good friend, he's been a real champion of the things that New York counties need. A little tidbit, we're, you know, the county's allocation directly will be about almost 20,000. It'll come in two tranches. So, not 20,000, 20 million. So 10 million, within about 60 days from now. And then, 10 million next year. So two chunks. And I think it all has to be spent or obligated by 2024.
Correct.
So, and also, interestingly, that it doesn't have to just be spent on county operations or county projects. So it is a little bit open. Heather McDaniel from IAED has pulled together an initial meeting of a few people to try to identify some kind of process. I think it would be important to coordinate, because all the other municipalities are going to get funds. So if we are aware that, you know, the city is going to spend money here, maybe we can spend money over there and try not to duplicate, but really coordinate how we use our money. So.
And Martha, I want to add a little edit to something you said in terms of it can be spent on. I think what I heard from him on things that are not county related is that they are pushing the Treasury Secretary for that level of flexibility, uh-huh. but we haven't gotten that just yet.
Okay, great. Good.
And we do have to use up our first, you know, it's over 2 years, and so we have to use up our first tranche before we can even get the second. So we're all waiting. So, yes, and you are correct. All the municipalities, I think what I understood is about 40-something, maybe $42 million for the county as a whole, not excluding the city. And so every municipality gets some amount.
It probably should be on a TCOG agenda, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. So, all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair. Committee with the action.
Okay. Thank you, Leslin. The Public Safety Committee has not met since our last meeting, but we'll be meeting this Thursday. And we're going to have a different format than our typical agenda. All of the legislators are invited, and the one topic we will be covering is the police reform proposals. We will be considering two resolutions. One, the statement of the plan, and we will be debating and probably amending some of the undertakings in the plan. And the second resolution is to consider setting up a community justice center in collaboration with the city of Ithaca that would work on implementation of the plan and tracking. I think we were looking for the right adjective, but basically doing the data analysis and coordination between the different departments in the county and the city that will be involved. It should be a full meeting. And if we do not finish business, we have a second meeting scheduled for March 23rd. The meeting this Thursday is at 3 o'clock. Next Tuesday, the 23rd, is at 3:30. And this is all set up for the legislature to have a special vote on the plan on March 30th. And other than that, I just wanted to move a resolution. Which
before
is
you go on with your resolution, Rich, I'm
resolution
see if
there
are any
D.
Rich? Rich, I just want to check quickly to see if there are any questions in your report. Any questions? Everybody got the dates? Thank you much, Lee. All right, go ahead with your resolution.
Yeah, I did have one more item on my report. I just wanted to let everybody know our jail population is at 46 today, which is a bit higher than it's been.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure why that is, but it has creeped up a bit. At any rate, have resolution D, appropriation from contingent fund, virtual conference suite technology systems, sheriff's office ID 9898, and I would move it.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Any discussion on the resolution? All right, vote.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries unanimously. Downtown Facilities Committee. Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. Downtown Facilities met on March 11th. Basically, we opened the meeting, passed the minutes, went to executive session, came out of executive session and closed the meeting. Sorry, it's not a very descriptive report, but that's what we did. And better luck next time. That's all I can say.
Thank you very much, Dave. Any questions for Dave? You followed Robert's rules. All right. And are there any other items or November filed resolutions? All right. May I have a motion to enter into executive session?
Leslyn, do you want to do the minutes first?
Oh, wait. I have minutes. Yes. Thank you. Dave, you threw me off of that one.
Get yourself shook up.
Minutes of the previous meeting, you threw me off, Dave. Move by Rich John. May I have someone second the minutes, please? Ann Corman. All in favor, any corrections, any discussion in the minutes? All right, all in favor of the minutes. Let's have a roll call.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries. Any other business before I go to executive session? All right. May I have someone move to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing real estate transactions and a brief personnel matter pertaining to a particular person? Move by Deborah Dawson. May I have a second, please? Seconded by Amanda Champion. All in favor of going into executive session?
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. We are in executive session.